Session number 17894, Reel 2.
Now, these problems you've just outlined in great detail, have they been overcome in the fly-by-wire Harrier? Have you flown the FBW Harrier?
I've flown the VSRA Harrier, which is the American equivalent. They had a YAV-8B at NASA Ames, the YAV-8B prototype, the only existing one, in fact, because the other one crashed. It's now in a museum. But I did a job a couple of years ago for Rolls-Royce, to go out to NASA Ames base at San Francisco for a couple of weeks and had a dozen hours in the beastie, and that was interesting. It's a single seater, whereas the British version, the VARC Harrier, is two seater, so you can have a safety pilot in the other cockpit. Theirs was a single seat. It wasn't the ideal situation, but it was accepted because that was the only airplane they were going to get, and they had a budget to do it, so they did it. Yes, they have been overcome, because we don't have controls in that type of airplane. You have inceptors. You have a right-hand inceptor and a left-hand inceptor, and you put a demand in. For example, in a conventional Harrier, if I wish to go to the right, for example, then from a steady hover, I would move the control column to the right slightly. Excuse me. When the aircraft started to roll, it would start to move to the right. I'd require a little bit more thrust, because I'm taking the thrust vector away from the vertical, so I'd have to move my left hand forward to increase the throttle. At some point, the aircraft would start to roll to the right on its own, so I'd have to put left aileron in to correct it. And as the aircraft was moving to the right, I'd then level the wings by putting left aileron in to roll it to the left, and then as it became wings level, I'd put the aileron back in the centre. And all those stick movements cause the airplane in the end to move slowly to the right, and when I wanted to stop, I'd have to do everything in reverse and it would stop. On the fly-by-wire Harrier, we have two inceptors, a right-hand inceptor and a left-hand inceptor, and in the hover for the aircraft in the States, it was just a matter of moving the stick in the direction one wanted to go. So if you wanted to go to the right, you move it to the right, and full-scale deflection gave 20 knots in that direction. So if I wanted 5 knots to the right, I moved the stick, half deflection to the right, and the aircraft moved. It rolled a bit, the power came up, it rolled off a bit, and once it got its 5 knots, it stopped moving. But it was all done on one inceptor, although...
What exactly are inceptors? Action,
it's just something you stick in your hand. It's you don't have a conventional control column in this particular airplane. You don't, when you pull the stick back, you don't raise the elevators. When you pull the stick back, whichever surface is required to move to give you what you've requested, i.e. what you've input, will move. So it might be the nozzles will move, the power will change, and the pitch will change, but not necessarily.
All control from the main stick?
All control from the... Well, it's not a main stick anymore. It's an inceptor. It's an input device.
It's still
to input
between your legs, though. Like the
it is, yes.
It's not little side sticks or anything like that.
No, it could be. It could be, but one has to get away from the idea of the stick being a stick or a control column, or pulling it back meaning pitch, because it doesn't necessarily mean that. When you pull the stick back, you're telling the aircraft computer that you want the aircraft either to move backwards in hover, or if you're in conventional flight, you want the nose to go up. Now, the computer might decide the best way to get the nose to go up is to move the nozzles down and increase the power, and leave the elevators where they are. So this is not... The stick is not a control of the elevators. It's a control of the pitch attitude. And you are inputting a request into the computer via this device. So rather than call it a control column, you call it an inceptor. It's the same on the left hand. You have your hand on a throttle. You push the throttle forward in the hover, you go up. So essentially the throttle becomes an elevating device in the hover. In conventional flight, you push your left hand forward on the throttle and the aircraft will accelerate. Well, on a fly-by-wire airplane, you call them inceptors. When you push your left hand forward, you're defining the, in the RAF system, when you push your left hand forward, you want the aircraft to go forward. So in conventional flight, you'll increase the power and you'll accelerate. In V-stop flight, the nozzles will go off slightly and that will push you forward. So it's not
so
a conventional
throttle. The nozzles are all part of the control loop then?
They are. It's not a conventional throttle left hand or stick in the right hand. It's a means of inputting your wishes into the airplane's computer.
Is that system going to be incorporated in squadron aircraft or not?
One of them will be incorporated in the a Stovall airplane that's coming out at the moment, the JAST solution. I suspect it will be the American version. The subtle difference of the two, the English version works essentially on R theta, on XY, and the American version works on R theta. If we imagine the aircraft in the hover, on the English version, the left-hand inceptor, when it's pushed forward, causes the aircraft to go forward in the hover. The right-hand inceptor, when you pull it back or push it forward, it causes the aircraft to go up and down. When you move it to the right or left, it causes the aircraft to go left or right. And that'll work in the hover or in conventional flight. In the American system, in conventional flight, when you push the left-hand forward, you go faster. Push the right-hand forward, you put the nose down, push it to the right or left, you'll roll left or right. In the hover, in the American version, the stick in, or the inceptor in the right hand defines the hover position, if you like, so that a steady hover is the stick in the null position. When you move it to the right, you'll get 20 knots movement to the right with full deflection. When you push it forward, you'll get 20 knots forward with full deflection. And obviously moving it back or to the left does the a similar thing. The left hand inceptor will move you up or down, which is a slightly different situation to the English. The way it works in practice, if you're hovering at a point and you wish to hover at a point, let's say in the 2 o'clock position, on the English aircraft you have to move the throttle forward and move the aileron to the right to get the aircraft to move towards the 2 o'clock, which is a little bit like doing an etch-a-sketch, if you've ever done that. Whereas with the American system, you just push the stick in the direction that you want to go, and the aircraft will move in that direction. So in the English one, you tend to ratchet across space, getting to the point that you want to go to, but the American one, you can go directly to it. The disadvantage to the American system is that you must have two separate control laws, one for the hover and one for conventional flight, because pushing the stick forward will only get you a maximum of 20 knots forward velocity, and that's no good for a fighter. It's got to accelerate to high speed, so you have to change the control system, and that's normally done on a switch, and you have a separate control law for the what the right and left hand inceptors are going to do depending on whether you're in the hover or in conventional flight, and someday something's going to go wrong. That's the disadvantage.
Going back to the less sophisticated and currently operational Harrier, once it's out of its hover and flying as a conventional aeroplane, are there any disadvantageous compromises that have had to be struck because of the V-stall capability, or does it fly just like a normal aircraft?
It flies just like a normal aircraft. The only disadvantage, if any, and I don't believe it is a disadvantage, is that because it's a very large fan engine, you've got big intakes, and that prevents the aircraft from going very high speed. It hits a brick wall at around 500, 550 knots, and doesn't. It will go faster than that. The Mark 1 Harrier, GR1, GR3, or the Harrier 1, is quite capable of supersonic flight at altitude, so it will go fast, but there is extreme drag from those great big elephant ear intakes, and that does limit the aircraft maximum speed. But it's a close air support aircraft. It makes a very good fist of point defence, and obviously the Navy are quite happy with it as a fighter, but as a close air support aircraft, it doesn't need to go supersonic. It just needs to be close to the troops that it's supporting. And that, therefore, is not a disadvantage. But that is the only major thing. anything, any major disadvantage of the configuration of the airplane. There's others in that the aircraft is a prototype. It's essentially the P-1127 developed, and it's got all the problems of a prototype, such that you have to take the wing off to change the engine. And whoever thought of an aircraft that spends all of its life deployed in the field, where for an engine change you have to take the wing off? And the Jaguar can change an engine in 3 hours. In a Harrier, you're lucky if you can do it in a day, because of that particular process. It's got a nose wheel steering system that when it fails it can go to full scale deflection, which is very embarrassing on the runway, because you just go off the side of the runway and possibly wreck the airplane. What else have we got? The initial Harrier had very poor field of view, particularly to the rear. The Harrier 2 is a lot better because the cockpit's been raised. Lots of little things like that are a disadvantage. It's very expensive, much more expensive than an equivalent aircraft that would go an equivalent distance and carry an equivalent weapon load. But that's because it's got the V-STOL capability. As it's the only effective V-STOL airplane in existence at the moment, then as well as being the most expensive one, it's also the cheapest. But I don't see that as an operational disadvantage. I think the major disadvantage is the high speed.
Have you flown the Sea Harrier?
Yes, I have. Not the FRS-2, but I've flown the FRS-1.
Is there any major difference between that and the RAF version?
It has the Harrier 1 wings, but the raised cockpit, similar to the Harrier 2. So in that respect, it's a good compromise. It's got a higher speed than the Harrier 2. The Harrier 2 has a supercritical wing, quite a fat wing, which is designed for low speed, carrying lots of weapons a long way. So it's very good for close air support. I don't think it's as effective as a fighter as the Sea Harrier, and I think the Sea Harrier is the best compromise for defence of a ship, because again, as I said, it's a faster airplane. Sea Harrier is my favourite, I have to say. I don't like the departure characteristics of the Harrier 2, and the auto-stabilisation system is such that it takes a lot of the feel out of the airplane, whereas the Sea Harrier is a very good development of the Harrier 1. I prefer, just as an aside, I don't like fly-by-wire airplanes. My opinion of those is that when you pull the stick back, you get the result. The result on the airplane is the perception of what the software engineer thinks that you ought to have when you decide you want the nose to go up. But with a classic airplane, then it's just pure pilot and aerodynamics, and the software engineers don't get involved. So I prefer the Sea Harrier. The Sea Harrier is my favourite Harrier, I have to say. Because it's not so much auto stabs, it still retains the excellent handling qualities of the Harrier 1, and also slightly faster than the Harrier 1, a lot slower than the Harrier 2, and enough vices to make it an interesting flight.
Yeah. What about the Hawk?
Delightful little airplane. Got about 800 hours on the Hawk. I instructed on it at Broadie. They used to say it was too easy for the students, too easy to fly, and therefore it didn't teach the students properly, but we found that if you loaded the students up to breaking point, then you could always tell the good ones from the bad, and it taught them just as well. In fact, it taught them better than the Hunter, because we could do more in the Hawk, because the aircraft was easy. You could spend your time teaching combat tactics and how to fly airplanes, applied flying, as opposed to pure flying that we used to have to teach in Hunter. So delightful little machine.
Now, how did you get involved in flying for the Shuttleworth Trust?
Right place at the right time, and the people that recruited me say the right person for the job. It was a luck of meetings. I've always wanted to get into historic aviation. Always had a bent towards that type of aeroplane. Got into a lot of a great fantasy world when flying the Chipmunk on the University Air Squadron, because that's a piston engine tailwheel machine with very pleasant handling characteristics. But the way it happened was during the 80s, in my Royal Air Force career, I was posted to Boscombe Down. They allowed me there to fly the Harvard. It took a long time to do that, took a long time to get to fly the Harvard at Boscombe because the boss of the squadron that operated it was on the transport side, and he didn't want any fast jet pilots flying his personal flying machine. So it was a case of asking him and asking him, and I buttonholed him in the bar at Boscombe Down every Friday night, and after about 12 months he got fed up and said, yes, you can fly it. So I learned to fly the Harvard.
Okay, you're running.
Running.
The Harvard.
Yeah, so I learned to fly the Harvard at on A Squadron at Boscombe Down. About 3 years later, I found myself at Farnborough and heard that the Harvard team at North Weald were short of a pilot. So I got in touch with them and they allowed me to join them. When I started to fly for the Harvard team, I moved to Rolls-Royce, left the Royal Air Force and moved down here at Filton. And during interviews for Rolls-Royce, I saw the Spitfire in the corner of the hangar. I looked at the airplane. I'd forgotten Rolls-Royce owned a Spitfire. I never even thought about it, but I saw it. And during my interviews, I had to ask the obvious question of, can I fly the Spitfire, please? They said, you need to be Tower World qualified. And I said, I fly Harvard. And they said, okay, that's fine. I said, is it that easy? They said, yeah. I said, what about the other pilots? You've got eight pilots working here and only one of them flies it. And they said, oh, they don't like to mess up the weekends. So I said, oh, well, I don't mind. Hoping that it wouldn't be noticed. But the chap that converted me to the Spitfire was none other than John Lewis, of Chief Pilot Shuttleworth Collection, then Chief Test Pilot British Airspace at Filton, and ex-Chief Test Pilot Rolls-Royce. He converted me to the airplane, briefed me, supervised my flying on it, and gave me a display authorisation on it. Watched me fly it for a couple of months, and in his own words, realised that I was of the right sort for the Shuttleworth Collection. And I can remember on a flight that we did together to Toulouse in November of 1989, when we were walking from the hotel we were staying at, the Campanile, which is a bed and breakfast type place, for want of any better description, very near the corporate terminal at Toulouse, Blagnac, they call it there. We were walking from there to the main terminal to get a newspaper, and he looked over at me and he said, have you ever thought of joining the Shuttleworth Collection? And I said, I thought you'd never ask. And that led to me joining the place in 1990 as what they call a postulant. You do 12 months of pushing airplanes and general dog's body and not even getting a sniff at anything.
I mean, it's a pure honorary post.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
And when you proved yourself keen enough to turn up at every show for 12 months and push airplanes, they allow you to fly the Tiger Moth. And you then gradually expand through the collection machines over 20 or 30 years. But I was very lucky in that John Lewis decided that I was of the right temperament, mentality and whatever to take over his post. And when his deputy moved to the States 3 years ago in 1996, it left the deputy's post vacant, which John offered to me. I accepted instantly after a couple of milliseconds of contemplation, and acted as his deputy for 2 years, and then he resigned as chief pilot last year. In fact, it was 86, at the end of 86, and I took over as chief pilot in September of 86. So I've done one season and just come out to my second.
Now, I'm very interested to know the impressions that you have from flying these old aeroplanes when you've been... Your whole education has been a modern one, modern technology, high speed. Mm. To go back to, say, the Spitfire or even the Gladiator or whatever you've flown there, do you have to sort of start your whole thinking all over again?
Not at all. Getting into Shuttleworth Collection aeroplanes is not something you can do within 12 months or 2 years. It takes about 5 years of quite hard work to get into the machines, because none of them are difficult to fly, but they have got some quite interesting handling characteristics. All of them, except the Blackburn 1912 monoplane, are unstable in at least one axis. The box kite, although we don't advertise it too much, is unstable around all three. It's dynamically unstable in pitch, similar in yaw, and neutrally stable in roll. Statically unstable around all three axes.
Now, is this saying or a replica?
It's a reproduction of an original. It's got an extra fin rudder at the back. Sorry, it's got an extra rudder at the back because we put a Rolls-Royce 0100 100 horsepower flat 4 in the airplane, which drives a smaller propeller than the original 50 horse name rotary. The propeller efflux doesn't touch the two outer fins, so we put a fin in the middle to help ground steering. But essentially it's very similar to the Source aeroplane, and that is very interesting. But they are different to fly, none of them are difficult, and it's only a matter of learning the skill. We choose test pilots, all of the pilots at Shuttleworth save one at the moment, the test pilots, and we choose test pilots because they're used to jumping in and out of different aeroplanes, and it's easier to unteach a test pilot and teach him a new skill because he's used to doing that with his normal day-to-day flight than it is to teach a guy that's maybe done a few hundred hours on that type of aeroplane but on nothing else. And we work back through the collection, so one starts on the Tiger Moth, which leads to the Gypsy Moths aircraft like the Avaratutor and the Tomtit. Those of us that have flown Spitfire before continue to fly it, but if you haven't, then we work up on the Harvard. We go from the Tiger Moth to the Magister to the Harvard, then into the Spitfire. The older ones are perhaps a bit more difficult. The Tiger Moth leads naturally through the Tutor to aircraft like the SE-5A and the Bristol Fighter, because they're similar. The Bristol Fighter then leads to an aircraft like the LVG, the German two-seat observation aeroplane, which is an absolute death trap, really. Awful machine. The original German pilots weren't allowed to fly them below 500 feet, weren't allowed to turn them below 500 feet. They are neutrally to unstable in roll, and the roll control power is very poor, so you can find yourself rolling with full opposite aileron and quite a good bit of rudder in the opposite direction, and it's still rolling. So not a very pleasant airplane to fly at all. And that then leads into the, once you've got the hang of flying something like that, leads into the older airplanes like the Avro triplane, which is a wing warper, which also has limited roll control but power, which leads to the Box Kite, which has got limited gnaw directions and limited power, which leads to the Blériot, which has got very little control, lots of instability and no power at all. In the middle of all this, you might go onto a rotary engine and learn how to control a rotary, which is a totally different skill, non-intuitive skill.
That's switch on, switch off, isn't it?
Essentially, that'll take about 5 minutes to describe.
Mm.
So, have we got enough room on this tape?
Yeah, we should do it, right?
Okay, you then go on to rotary, which should lead to aircraft like the Sopwith Pup, Sopwith Triplane. That then leads to the Blackburn, which is a wing warper with rotary engine. So, you don't jump into the interesting stuff immediately around at Shuttleworth. You go through a process of unteaching modern techniques and reteaching the old ones. But once you've flown them a few times, there's no major problem in flying the Shuttleworth airplanes, provided you've got a good quality pilot to start with, which is, we come back to the original statement, that's why we pick test pilots as Shuttleworth pilots.
Mm.
Rotary engines, they're interesting beasts. They don't have a conventional throttle control. You can modulate the power on a rotary from perhaps about 50% power to 100%. There's normally two levers. The single lever rotaries, which have a very small modulation of power, two lever rotaries and three lever rotaries. The collection, we have a three lever and four two levers, and we've modified the three lever into a two lever because the third lever will make it too dangerous. There's too many variables on that. But the way the system works is that fuel air mixture is introduced into the crank shaft, and that is partly centrifuged and partly pressured out into the cylinders to be burnt. And the interesting bit is how that mixture becomes a mixture and how it gets into the crankshaft of the engine. The two levers in the cockpit control the left-hand or outboard lever, referred to as the block tube, or the fuel air lever, controls the fuel air mixture that goes into the engine. It controls the total fuel air mixture. It doesn't control the mixture at all. It just controls the amount that goes in. And that will control your RPM between, say, about 800 and 1050 to 1100 on the ground. The fine adjustment lever, which is the inboard lever, which is slightly smaller, sometimes referred to as the petrol lever, or the Tampier filter tap lever, controls the amount of fuel that enters into that fuel air mixture. And the idea is to adjust the fuel air mixture, or the petrol lever, or the Tampier filter tap lever, to give it the ideal amount of petrol going into the block tube carburetor to keep the engine running. And if you get that lever too rich, the mixture will be too rich and the engine will stop, and it'll take about 30 seconds to clear because the crankcase and cylinder heads will be full of fuel. If you get it too lean, the engine will stop because it's too lean, and it takes about 5 seconds to get it back. So the best way to stop the engine, if you need to stop it, is to make the mixture too lean. There's a graduated quadrant along which these two levers operate, normally graduated from 0 to 10. The system that we use for running the engines is that normally the fuel will come from a pressurised tank, so the tank is pressurised by the pilot pumping it up to, let's say, 2.5 psi. Both levers are set off, the ignition switches are set off, and the ground crew call. The ground crew will then squirt fuel into each cylinder head, priming the engine. He does that by having a syringe full of petrol, and he depresses the exhaust valves and squirts a little bit of fuel into each cylinder in turn. The engine will then be spun a couple of times just to distribute the fuel, and when the ground crew decides that the mixture and the distribution are sufficient, he will call ready for start. The pilot then sets the outboard lever, the fuel air lever, to position roughly around number 3 on the graduated gauge, which should give him the minimum RPM. We use knowledge on that. We note the settings for each engine before every time we fly, and you normally take an average depending on the conditions of the day. The ground crew will call ready to start, he'll call contact, pilot will call contact, putting the switches on, and the ground crew will spin up the engine. There's no fuel going into the engine from the through the carburetor, because although the block tube lever has been set at 3, that means that the block tube carburetor is a third open, but because the petrol lever is still closed, there's no fuel going in. The engine should fire, and it'll rev up to about 800 or 900 RPM, and as the prime is burnt off, the engine will stop, but it'll still be rotating. And before it stops rotating, the pilot must move the petrol lever forward to catch the engine before it stops. Now, if he moves it forward too slowly, the engine will stop because it's too lean. If he moves it too fast, it will stop because it's too rich. And if he gets it absolutely right, the engine will run. And it's then really a case of adjusting the two levers, listening to the engine. A heavy note means too rich, a light note means too lean, to get the minimum useful idle RPM. And the engine is run up for about 30, 40 seconds at that RPM to warm it up. A wind-up signal is given. The aircraft is obviously already chocked. Ground crew are going to sit on the tail to make sure the tail doesn't come up, and the levers will then be moved. The left-hand block tube lever is moved forward to increase the revs. The engine normally stops at this stage because the petrol lever is too far back, but that's not a bad thing because the lean engine will come back online very quickly, and the petrol levers then move forward slowly to get the engine running again. And lever positions are adjusted to get the maximum RPM that you can achieve, and it's normally around 1050, 1100. Less than 1000 we don't go flying, more than 1000 we do. The positions are noted, the levers are then brought back, the petrol lever is brought back and the engine will stop, but it will still rotate and stop firing. The fuel air lever is brought back to the point where we discovered would give a safe idle, and the petrol lever slowly brought forward to catch the engine before it stops at that idle position, and it should now be running at about 800 RPM. That is too much RPM for level flight normally, and probably much too much RPM for taxiing. We then wave the chocks away and very quickly kill the engine on the ignition, because if we don't, it'll immediately run over the poor ground crew chap that's pulled the chocks out, and he's not very happy about that when that happens. So we stop the engine using the flip switch, as it's called, the ignition switch on the control column. Before it stops, we release it and it revs up a little bit, and then we stop it again, and we keep the RPM at a low figure by continually blipping. We then moved on to the runway, and we have a limit at the shuttle with collection of 2.5 minutes running time on the ground. More than that, the engine will overheat, the exhaust valves will lose their temper, and the engine will either run rough or it'll stop. So it's a maximum, although rotors aren't supposed to overheat, it's normally a maximum of 2.5 minutes running time. The aircraft will be brought out onto, moved out onto the runway. The ground crew will be waved away, and the pilot will organise his levers for takeoff.